Are you ready for a war?
It's a trap.
Game over, man. Game over.
You just killed a helicopter with a car.
I was out of bullets.
Say what again? Say what again? I dare you.
Hello, everybody. I hope you're frightened. You want to know why you should be frightened? Because we're reviewing The Frighteners on the BCD Flixers Movie Review Podcast. Today is March the 8th, and as I already stated, we'll be reviewing The Frighteners, directed by Peter Jackson and produced by Robert Zemeckis. But first, welcome my hosts.
Daniel Stoll.
And Bama Rogers.
Winter's coming.
And winter was coming in Oklahoma. And then I was like, crap, Rob Stark was wrong because it all went north. The White Walkers didn't come far enough south to stop us. Anyway, before we go ahead and get into our review, as always, we're going to start with the top five at the box office, and I got some interesting box office news this week. Opening number one, to no one's surprise, was Jack and the Giant Slayer, $27.2 million.
No, was that the one with Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Yeah, he was awesome in the movie.
He was really cool.
Really awesome. But, I mean, the whole movie was stupid and cheesy, but it was fun. I mean, I had a good time.
But you could tell that's what they were going
for. I mean, for the most part, I was kind of confused who they were marketing it to, because there was sometimes I'm like, it was a toy for kids, and they were trying to be violent, but then they wouldn't show, like, the giants biting the heads off. I was like, why don't you show? It's a PG-13 movie. Come on, you can get away with that. But, I mean, no biggie. I mean, it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
I wouldn't say it's the greatest thing in the world, but, I mean,
I was engaged.
Definitely very enjoyable.
Yeah, it was enjoyable. I mean, I don't regret paying $7. If I never watched it again, I wouldn't exactly be disappointed. But anyway, what's interesing is this movie is actually, they're predicting it's going to be a bigger loss than last year's John Carter. That's right, folks. We found our box office bomb of the year. This movie costed around $195 million to make, and there was probably an estimated $100 million marketing campaign for this movie, and it opened with less than a tenth of that.
Man.
So, yeah, and with... Yeah, some of the newcomers like Oz the Great and Powerful and a few other movies open up in March. It's like, oof, this movie looks like it's in trouble. So
I'm excited for Oz.
Well, I am excited for Oz, too. I get to see it tomorrow.
Me, too.
And by tomorrow, I mean Tuesday, before this podcast is up. All right, anyway, Identity Thief, $9.7 million.
It's second?
It's second. But honestly, this weekend the box office was pretty weak.
Yeah, besides Jack the Giant Slayer.
Nothing open, but I mean, like, as really far as, like, actual much. People going to the movies, like, $9.7 million is not a very big number, too, at all. That's really low, below $2 million. 21 and Over, another new movie that opened up this weekend, only opened with $8.8 million. Snitch, which opened last weekend, it was $7.77 million. Oh, this is a photo finish for 4th and 5th place, because Snitch was $7.77 and The Last Exorcism Part 2, that's right, people, do you hear the inherent contradiction? opened with $7.72 million. It was really close. It was really close. Apparently, you can have a Last Exorcism more than once. So clearly, the first movie, everything you saw was a lie, because it wasn't the last.
You can have a contradicting title and still make millions of dollars.
Well, apparently $7.72 million. It's not like they paid a lot to have that one made anyway, so... Anyway, that's the top five. Hopefully, Oz will come through and bust some records. I have a few, at least up the ante a little bit.
I hope so. I love James Franco.
Well, I like James Franco. It's Sam Raimi and James Franco. James Franco is an interesting person. Let's talk about James Franco. Okay, you know James Franco?
He played Harry.
Harry Osborne, Spider-Man.
From Spider-Man.
He was in Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
He was in 127 Hours. Very diverse actor. Very well-read guy, too, if you ever have interviews with him. He's really smart. Very, like, I mean, when I say well-read, I mean, like, educated.
I might have an interview with him.
You had an interview with him?
Yeah, maybe.
Dude, call me up when that happens. I'll sit down with you.
We just have him come on the podcast.
James Franco, special guest. All right, folks, tune in. James Franco will come on and talk about why marijuana and pornography is an art form. There we go.
Next week.
Tune in. But no, anyway, I just had this conversation about James Franco. He actually did, and the reason I brought this up is because I totally read an article. He was defending pornography as an art form. And I was like, well.
Interesting.
I draw a line somewhere. I mean, I'm pretty open-minded, but I'll draw a line somewhere. But, anyway, it was an interesting article. He was... Anyway, but he's got this very odd... Like, he's really super intelligent, like, great actor. But what I find really intriguing about him is that he's got this... His humor is, like, so, like, juvenile stoner humor.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like something...
Well, because he literally plays a stoner in Pineapple Express.
Pineapple Express, yeah, right. But I mean, that's...
But then he does, you know, something... Well, I guess you could say kind of intelligent with... Oz.
Yeah. Well, a little more creative. But, I mean, he also was doing... He also, if remember, he did Your Highness. And I'm not bashing him at all, because I think those Pineapple Express is hilarious. So,
oh, yeah.
Lots of one-liners. Your Highness, that was another one. Like, he just, it's just so weird because, like, you'll see him do something like 127 hours, like, dang, that was amazing. In the next movie, he does his, like, some like juvenile, like high school level humor, and I'm like, James Franco,
he doesn't get typecast.
That's great. So, no, and I applaud him. I'm just commenting on this whole point of this is because I think this guy's a very interesting fellow. That's all I'm saying, in a good way.
Why is he not more popular?
I would say he's actually moderately popular. I'd say he's moderately popular,
but I think he should be.
He's not a like superstar power, but I'd say he's definitely like bottom of your A-listers. I mean, I think. He's fairly recognizable to a lot of people. He's no George Clooney yet, but anyway, James Franco, interesting person. Check it out next week. Porn and marijuana. All right. So,
wait, you know who I think he should work with at some point? Robert Downey Jr. Just think about that for a second.
He could be the bad guy in Iron Man 8.
He could the next Iron Man 8.
No, not the next one. Iron Man 8. We're saving Iron Man 8. Okay, when Iron Man is
he'll be in Phase Four of the Avengers.
Listen, Iron Man 8 is going to take place all within Robert Downey Jr.'s head. That's the plot right there, and he's going to be fighting his inner self, which is going to be the stoner James Franco. There we go. Franco, you're awesome. If you ever, for some reason, hear this podcast,
somehow
we love you. So. Still, any thoughts on James Franco while we're talking? He just did a little funky hand motion, so I take that as a no. All right.
You trying to Jedi mind trick us or something?
Oh, speaking of Jedi mind trick.
Crap, I shouldn't have said that.
Did anyone else catch the Obama Star Wars Star Trek reference this week? No. In the news. We're not going to get the politics changed, but he was talking about how he's like, hey, listen, I have compromised, and I've got this bill down to like the bare minimum of what I'll take. He says we've written it, and he said I just can't, in his Obama voice, Jedi mind meld these people into doing the right thing. So there was tons of memes that blew up all over the internet about it and everything. Because what's funny is Jedi's don't mind meld; they mind trick. Mind meld is actually a Star Trek thing. So he like combined it. That's right, not combined. He combined it. Two references. Two series. Either Obama is a freaking genius, or he just got his Star Trek and Star Wars confused. I'll leave that to the ambiguity. Up to you listeners. Comment. Obama and James Franco.
Or he was
starring in Iron Man 8 2025.
Or he was trying too hard to make a funny joke and screwed it up.
I don't think it was a joke. The way he said it wasn't very... It was kind of sarcastic, honestly. And not like in a funny way.
Okay, he was trying to be sarcastic.
He was trying to be relevant. Well, I thought it was funny. Anyway... So, going on to our real news. Now, we're talking about James Franco, Obama, and Iron Man 8.
From the box office.
I don't know where James Franco... Oh, because of Oz.
Yes.
That's right. All right. So, news of the week. Stole anything to inform us of?
Yes, actually. The other day, I was watching TV. I believe I was watching the channel A&E, and I saw a preview for a show that caught my interest. This will be interesting to you guys who are Alfred Hitchcock fans, especially if you've seen the film Psycho, which was...
Well, if you're listening to this podcast and not listening to Psycho, first off, put the stop now, go watch the movie, come back.
It's an awesome movie. It's basically the original slasher.
Yeah.
It's basically what it is, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, who's an amazing director. I'm a huge fan of him. Anyway, A&E is going to create a show. It's called Bates Hotel. The whole point of the show is that they are going to dive into the psyche of Norman Bates as he's a teenager, which Norman Bates is the villain, basically, in Psycho. And they're going to dig into his psyche and his relationship with his mom and kind of dig into that and see kind of how he became who he was in the movie Psycho. And they've actually, the people that are producing it are actually the producers of Lost, for you Lost fans out there.
Yeah, it's Carlton Cuse, I think, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
No Damon Lindelof for all you Lindelof haters, because there's lots of you guys out there.
Right. But they've got Verma Farmiga as Norman Bates' mom, and then a guy named Freddie Highmore, I've never heard of him, as Norman Bates. And he actually looks a lot like the Norman Bates from Psycho, as if he was a teenager.
On a random Lost connection. I always thought...
Hold on, I've got a random Lost.
Okay.
Richard Alpert is going to be in this.
Dude, because I was totally going to talk about how the first time I watched that movie, after I watched Lost, I was like, I swear, Norman Bates is Richard Alpert. I don't know why. He's going to be in the show?
He's going to be in the show. He's going to play the sheriff of the town around.
Of course he is. Oh, my gosh. Dude, Lost connections everywhere.
So he's going to play that. It comes out March 18th. That's a Monday night, 9 o'clock in Central Time, 10 o'clock Eastern Time. So, anyway, I know that I really liked the movie Psycho, and I think that this, it looks really well done. It looks like it could be a really good show. It depends on what they kind of do with it. It could flop majorly, and then there'll be a bunch of Hitchcock lovers who are bashing on the show. But
I'm sure purists will bash on anything because they love to do that more than anything else.
But you know, this could be cool. I'd like to see what they do with it and kind of dive into the psyche of how Norman Bates became who he was in regards to the relationship with his mom.
There's going to be some Freudian psychology over that crap, man. Lots of Freudian psychology. That guy's got a mommy complex. Okay, Bama. Wait, what you got going? What is new this week? What are you going to inform us? How are you going to feed our curiosity?
Well, normally on this podcast we have something, you know, from the next X-Men or...
Which, by the way, there were two casting announcements this week, but we are not going to mention it because we're not talking about that anymore. That's on taboo for now.
We've covered those enough already. I'm actually going to be talking about something from Disney. Disney is going to be doing a live-action Cinderella movie. Now, you're probably wondering, who in the world are they going to get to play Cinderella? Hermione Granger herself, Emma Watson.
Yeah, Emma Watson. There we go.
I think this is a really interesting pick for this. I mean, obviously, everyone's seen her from the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah, I just saw Perks of Being a Wallflower a couple weeks ago. Excellent movie. She was great in it. I mean, like, the whole movie was great, and she was great in it, too, so it was really cool.
I'm really glad that she can kind of step away from what she... I mean, she grew up with Harry Potter, essentially. Right. So I'm glad to see that she's going to be stepping out of the bounds of
the
magical world of Hogwarts and going into something different. Because, I mean, two very conflicting characters just on how their characteristics are. I mean, Cinderella, you know, this hard-working girl with stepsisters and stepmother, you know, and all that jazz. And then, you know, just the nerdy, smart girl in school from Harry Potter. So... I'm looking forward to seeing this eventually.
Leviosa. She's a wand.
Not Leviosa.
Leviosa. Yeah, that girl. The time traveler girl. Who's been
the time
every
traveler.
Harry Potter fan when they read the books, that was the dream girl. Yeah, she's the one. Okay, well.
Luna, man.
Huh?
Luna Lovegood.
Oh, if you're into that type of stuff, yeah.
You're into the weird.
I'm just joking. I think Luna Lovegood is an awesome character.
She is
but
awesome
let's character. Let's not go there. Let's
Luna
because
awesome.
She is awesome. She is freaking
the,
awesome.
The actor they got for
and
Luna
the actress
was
is
really
great
good.
Too. Yeah, I agree. Well, I got some news today. I think I might have mentioned this movie before. It's called Transcendence. This is produced by Christopher Nolan, and it's going to be directed by Wally Fenster. Now, if you remember Wally Fenster, he's actually been Christopher Nolan's been their cinematographer. On all of Nolan's movies, I think all the way back to probably Memento, director of photography. He's been his director of photography on all of his movies since probably Memento. And Christopher Nolan's like, hey, I'm great friends with this guy. He wants to make awesome movies, so I'm going to help him launch his career. And Warner Brothers, since I keep making you billion-dollar movies, hand me the money to make it in this movie.
Show me the money!
That's right. So, Wally Fenster is now going to be directing this movie produced by Christopher Nolan called Transcendence. And it is, they set a date this week for April 25th, 2014. Now, other than Nolan being attached, what else is interesting about Transcendence? Well, first off, it's a cerebral sci-fi movie, which I like, huge fan. But two notable stars they have already cast, Johnny Depp, I mean, and everybody and their brother loves Johnny Depp these days, and Paul Bettany. Now, you guys probably remember from Paul Bettany from such movies as Iron Man and Iron Man 2. And the Avengers, not as a character, but as a voice, as Tony Stark's voice. Or he was also in Priest, and A Knight's Tale. So, needless to say,
who was he in A Knight's Tale?
He was the naked dude. Remember the guy that just passed?
I
can't remember his name. Chaucer. How did I miss? It's Chaucer.
How do you forget Chaucer?
I need to watch the movie again. Anyway,
I love A Knight's Tale.
Two of those guys, and I think Paul Bettany is actually a really cool actor. So. I'm really interested to see what happens. I think Johnny Depp apparently gets turned into a computer. Like, his brain gets, like, digitized into a computer. And then he, like, tries to take over the world or something like that. Something along those lines. Some weird sci-fi. Something that sounds like it's out of the Twilight Zone. So, that is my news for the week. Check out. Keep an eye on that Transcendence. It really does, for me, it sounds like a really, really crazy Twilight Zone episode. And that's the thing. I'm convinced Christopher Nolan would be the perfect fit for the Twilight Zone movie. But I feel like Inception... honestly, in a way, was a giant episode of the Twilight Zone, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, just, you know, without the cool intro.
Right. Without the brand, but the type of story this type of stories he tells, The Prestige.
Yeah.
Inception. Even Memento, to an extent. Those are all very Twilight Zone esque. They're very cerebral, dark. I mean, and they've got twists. So I think, I don't know. Anyway, so since he's not ever going to do that Twilight Zone movie that I want him to make. He's going to make all these other Twilight Zone esque movies, and, you know, it's helping his buddy Wally out. And by the way, side note, Wally won Academy Award for cinematography for Inception. So that's all we got for today. Moving on, we are going to review The Frighteners. Okay, so IMDb had literally the crappiest summary imaginable for this movie. So I was like, what the crap? So you know where I went? Rotten Tomatoes. And I got an overly long explanation, but I'm going to read it anyway.
Really, this explanation is just a line from the movie.
What does it say?
When you go through a traumatic experience, it kind of alters your attitude.
Which is
That's exactly a line from the movie.
So someone didn't write, they're too lazy to write, they just took a quote from the movie. So I stole Rotten Tomatoes and I modified it a little bit, and here we go. Drake Bannister, played by Michael J. Fox, has genuine psychic powers, but he doesn't use them to help people, but rather he generates cases for his supernatural private eye firm by harassing a group of hapless ghosts into staging hauntings and poltergeists in the homes of likely marks. Bannister's world turns on its head when he starts noticing real hauntings around town, ghostly assassinations that seem to be tied to the execution 20 years earlier of a brutal serial killer. Lucy Lunsky, played by Trini Alvarado, the wife of one unlucky victim, teams up with Bannister to get to the bottom of the killings and find out what shut in Patricia Bradley, played by Dee Wallace Stone, and her witchy mother, played by Julia McCarthy, have to do with the sinister killing spree. So that's a so-so summary. It's better than IMDb.
It's pretty good.
All right. Well, you know what? What are your initial thoughts on this movie?
Okay, I knew nothing about this movie going in. I didn't really know what to think of it. At first, I thought it was going to be like kind of a scary horror type film. I'm glad it didn't go that way because that's just not really my cup of tea. I think I was really surprised when the ghost appeared out of his trunk right at the beginning.
Yeah,
I was like, whoa! I really wasn't expecting this, and I had no idea that he would actually be teaming up with spirits that hadn't passed on to the afterlife. I would have to say that I really enjoyed it. As I always say, I wouldn't say it's really great by any stretch of the imagination. The acting is really, really pretty solid, especially from Michael J. Fox. I'd say it's pretty decent.
All right. Stoll, what do you think?
You know what? Same thing. I knew absolutely nothing about this. I didn't know where it was going, what it was doing. I didn't know what it had to do with. But after watching it, I feel like it was a fairly fun movie. I do think this, though. I think that had I watched it in the 90s when it was made in 1996, or people that watched it while in the 90s, this was probably a lot more fun to watch. I feel like it doesn't stand the test of time that well, if that kind of makes sense. But I do think that, you know, it was fun. It was enjoyable. There were some things about it I liked. You know, it was just a fun little story. I didn't think there was anything great or amazing about it. But, you know, it was an all right movie.
Well, you know, I'm right on there with you guys. I enjoyed the movie fine. It was funny. It was dark. I think it definitely had some serious identity issues. At least I thought so. It was kind of confused. A lot of times it felt very confused.
I mean, it says here that it's a comedy / horror. I can't really put it into those categories.
Well, there's sometimes when it wants to be a horror, and there's other times when it wants to be a comedy. It's because Cabin in the Woods wrecked this with comedy horrors. They did it so perfectly. It's like,
well, they didn't go over the top enough to make it super comedy,
right? But they didn't
take it serious enough to really make it a horror movie. They really, it just kind of played that line a little bit.
It was really cheesy for sure.
They stepped over the fence a little bit, and got back on the fence, and went to the other side, and just kind of went back and forth with it. They never explored the area on the other side.
Not really. But I think it was a fun movie. I was entertained. I think it was a pretty solid movie from the 90s. It had a very Ghostbusters feel to it. Yeah. Ghostbusters, yeah. And honestly, and here's the point I wanted to get to, Back to the Future. I honestly, one of the things I thought of when I was watching this, I was like, this is Beetlejuice meets Back to the Future meets Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and when I say Back to the Future, obviously not the time travel and stuff, but like that kind of cheesy, campy feel. I mean, and I know with Michael J. Fox, it's that the connection is just more there. I mean, well, like, some of his
mannerisms, being Bannister, were kind of similar to what Marty.
Right. Well, like, he was playing the character.
He would, you know, give these facial expressions, and he's like, "Oh, that's, you know, that's something from Back to the Future. I've seen this."
Well, movie. It wasn't even just like his mannerisms, but like the style of the movie, the way it was filmed and everything and executed. I was like, that just feels like something from that era. Maybe not necessarily. Maybe not specifically Back to the Future, but movies of that era. And again, Ghostbusters being one of them. I was like, it really feels like one of those types of movies. Except for made a decade later.
This was had to be one of the last movies that he was able to make, wasn't it? When did he start having...
Michael J. Fox? It was late 90s, so this is probably one of the last ones.
I would say this is probably one of the last ones he was able to make before he, you know, got sick.
His Parkinson's and everything. Yeah, I think you're probably right. I thought he did a good job.
Yeah, I thought he did too.
I thought the movie had some interesting twists.
I realized that the wife, he kind of associates with, and they try to work together to figure it out. I believe she's in Groundhog Day.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, anyway.
I want to talk about the style a little bit. I mean, overall, I thought the movie was all right. Style-wise, though, would you guys agree? Kind of a Ghostbuster-y thing. And something interesting, I noted already, Robert Zemeckis, who directed Back to the Future, and that was another connection I drew, produced the movie. But, again, that's not a direct connection. I just felt like that style was still there, that kind of 80s cheese was there. The movie was written by Peter Jackson, his wife, Fran Walsh, who also did all the Lord of the Rings stuff together. Do you guys have any observations about the kind of style?
I totally agree that it's that Ghostbusters type style. I think it kind of hurts the movie a little bit because it's like, it doesn't really have a pure straight identity of what it was trying to do. It was still very enjoyable nonetheless, but I think it did hurt it a little bit that it couldn't be identified, either comedy or horror.
Right. And I'm all about breaking down the binaries between horror. I mean, like, doing something new is cool and trying to transcend genres and kind of mesh genres, that's cool. But this movie, instead of them meshing together to beautifully make a new product, to mix them into a recipe, to make a new cake, they kind of just get thrown together and, like, it's a train wreck at times. Because, again, you're, like, watching it and you're like, oh, my gosh, this is really dark, trying to be scary. But at other times, cuckoo. Cartoony. I guess that'll lead to my next question, though. Though, you guys think it's kind of trying to be both and not succeeding, then?
Well, like I said before, it was on the fence, and it would go to one side for a little while, get back on the fence, go to the other side. It never explored either comedy or horror. It never really delved into either one. I mean, if they maybe took the comedy a little bit further and maybe even take the horror a little bit further. I mean, they could have done both at the same time or just done one more than the other. I think it would have been a little bit better. But they couldn't find that good balance, I don't think.
I mean, yeah, I agree with that. I feel like it kind of felt like it wanted to be something and it was just too afraid to go where it needed to go to become something, because they were afraid if it went there, and then it would have been too cheesy or too whatever, and it wouldn't have worked. And so it kind of just tried to stay in that little bit of a middle ground.
What I think I'm hearing you guys say is you think it played it way too safe.
Yes.
Yeah, it played it safe. I think that was actually one of my complaints about it, because it felt like it relied so much on that 80s comedy horror thing where it was like, all right, we got a military go. I mean, like, you know, just little things. Yeah. Like, you got the guy who played Full Metal Jacket. Yeah. The general from that, I can't remember. I've got it down here somewhere. Lee Ermey, the guy who has that military voice. I mean, just, and then he pulled out the machine guns, and I don't know. Just lots of times I felt like it really was. And then the racial stereotypes, you know, the black guy. Anyway. So, you know, it just felt like one of those types of movies. I guess that leaves my last question concerning the style. And who do you think the audience really was for this movie? And this is where I had the hardest time when I was thinking about it. I'm like, you know, this movie, I think that the identity problems it has is most evident, and you ask when you watch the movie, like, who is this for? Well, it's cartoon over the top, like what kids would enjoy, and it's funny, and it's even got kid jokes.
Okay, for 1996, it was rated R.
Right.
Now, if that was by today's standards, I think it would be a PG-13.
Yeah, probably. I'd have to check again.
I don't really think there was much in the movie that would make it an R rating.
No, not really. I can't remember. They probably had like a couple F words in there or something like that.
There were a few curse words. I don't think there were any F words.
Well, if there were no F words, then I mean that's the one that pushes over PG-13 R movies.
All the killings were done, you know, within the body. So that, well, I mean, there was some blood, but there wasn't all that much.
Right.
So I really think, by today's standards, it would be a PG-13, so it would be kind of that teenage, young adult age range.
I could totally see that. So you think it would work better today than it did in 1986?
Not with the current, not with its CG.
Well, okay. Take that aside, though. I do want to get to the CG. That's my next point.
That aside, I think it'd be a pretty decent.
Like if they released it today with modern effects and the whole nine yards, do you think that would be? And I think it would actually work better because it'd be a nostalgia film for adults. But then also, it's the goofy silliness for teenagers can laugh at it.
Yeah, with modern effects and stuff, I think this could be better nowadays.
Right.
Then it wasn't
fair enough, and I think I agree. I think it would work great as a nostalgia film. I really do. Like, not exactly remaking Ghostbusters, but we're trying to do something really similar. I totally agree with that. I don't think for the time, though, it was particularly anything special because it wasn't far enough removed. So we're going to talk about, before we start hashing out the story, one last thing I want to talk about on the technical and, like, the form of the movie. CGI. And you mentioned it. I know you kind of hinted at it. I think this movie will rely way too much on CGI, because it doesn't hold up at all. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of CGI in this movie.
Really, the worst part of the CGI for me was the Reaper death, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Oh, it looks like a cartoon.
That one looked very odd, very out of place. I know this is 96. But just, you know, looking at it from today's perspective, it doesn't age well.
And again, we have this thing the last couple decades have been going crazy with CGI. We're like, oh, we don't need to use practical effects. We can just put it on computer, which we don't realize is this, maybe not so much these days, but like, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, those effects don't hold up well anymore. Yeah. They really, really don't. They weren't ready for it. They were trying to jump the gun too much.
The ghosts, I think, were
the ghosts were fine. Okay. They were fine. I mean, you could tell if they were on green screen a little bit, but I mean, it wasn't terrible.
But for the most part, the ghosts were fine. Just when it was the Reaper, Death, whatever you want to call them, that it looked really out of place.
No, it really did. It looked like a cartoon. That scene at the end that we'll talk about in the spoiler section, where they're in that tunnel thing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was so bad. I was like, wow. Oh, it looked like, I mean, oh boy, it was bad. Stoll, anything on the CGI?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 90s, you know, it was all right probably in the 90s when you were watching it, you know, but like you said, it just doesn't hold up today. It's pretty easy to tell at certain times when things are going on that don't fit in, stuff like that. So, yeah, I'd agree with that, but I feel like for the time, it probably wasn't that bad, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure at the time it was okay. I just wish we had had enough hindsight to realize, and I think we're going to run into this problem a lot too. Is technology keeps advancing, like, and even George Lucas he's a victim of this too. Going CGI crazy, and then when technology gets that much better, when you go back, it's like, ooh, man, that didn't look as good as we thought at the time. You know, at the time it was like, oh my gosh, amazing. But
96 was the same year that Space Jam also came out, so. If you want to compare it to something else.
Yeah, but that was okay. That's a totally different special effects thing.
I know, but I'm just saying.
Because literally all that was Michael Jordan acting on the green screen. This was like, there was a lot of other things. And they were using 3G animation versus, you know, again, just putting Michael Jackson.
You mean Michael Jordan? Sure,
Michael Jackson was there somewhere. Go look. You just didn't catch the scene.
He's in the background.
He's in the audience watching the game.
Watching the game, yeah. Michael Jordan, sorry, thank you. Michael Jordan on a green screen. I mean, your point. Yeah, I mean, that's where technology.
I'm just saying,
it was the same year. But we've been doing that with 2D animation on green screen for a long time before. I mean, this, what they were doing here was actually integrating green screen special effects, 3D rendering into scenes.
Right.
But anyway, that's the point. Okay. Do you guys want to hit on any story points before? I have a couple of themes I would like to hit on and kind of talk about. But do you guys have any story points that you thought were intriguing, any cool plot twists or characters you want to comment on?
Go ahead.
The FBI agent
was
very creepy.
Oh my gosh, but he was creepy.
I also felt he looked a lot like Hitler.
He kind of looked like a neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
He really did.
He had that hairstyle.
Without the mustache, he didn't have any facial hair.
No, but he had like the black hair, and he had tattoos all over his body. And
which, that was kind of creepy.
That was creepy.
That was really creepy when he rips it off, and he's like, I can do it with my mind. Well, and that was interesting because the reason he was like that, though, is because apparently he was the FBI guy who investigated all the cults and stuff. So apparently he bought into some of the different cults
and
stuff.
He thought he could move a car with his mind.
Oh, Milton Dammers, played by Jeffrey Combs. Yeah, that guy was creepy. I thought that at the same time, too.
But I think he played the part.
Oh yeah,
pretty well.
He was just very funny as like, again, he was like a cartoon kind of character. Not that he was animated, but like the way the character was like kind of over the top a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then of course the ghosts, they were all like,
they're all over the top.
Over the top. Even the judge, if that one scene, he walks in just firing the pistols off and crap. It was fun. I enjoyed it, but at the same time, it totally is inconsistent with the tone they try to establish in the movie. Sex with the Egyptian.
That was funny.
Why in the middle of that scene?
He's just like, oh, it has good teeth.
That's how I like it when they stay down.
Pretty skull, good teeth, and that goes into it, and then you see like his butt come up.
Yeah.
And he's like, I like it when they lay still.
That's true.
That part I was just like, why is this in this movie?
It was hilarious, that's why. And it was so
but
wrong.
It was just...
You know, he was funny. Michael J. Fox, very funny. I thought it was really funny when that douchebag at the beginning, what was his name?
Ray?
Yeah, Ray. I was so glad he died, just because of irony, because he was such a tool.
Peter Dobson, who played Ray, was Elvis Presley from Forrest Gump.
Oh yeah, that's right. I remember that.
You don't really ever see his face, but I could definitely tell. Because he was out of focus with Forrest Gump, but I could tell. Yeah, this guy definitely was in there. So just interesting little tidbit
connection there. Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was really ironic when he died though, because he was being such a jerk the whole time. And he's like, "I'm 29, I can't die yet." And then that set up the whole thing with the numbers on the head. That was probably the coolest mystery in the whole movie. Was what do the numbers mean? How fast did you guys figure that out? I'm just curious, because I remembered when I watched it from the first. I'd watched it a few years ago. And I remembered, but like, did you guys? I'm just kind of curious. Was that intriguing to you guys? What do the numbers mean on their heads and stuff like that?
I was intrigued by it. I didn't know what it was up until it was kind of revealed. I wasn't really looking into it that much.
Well, cause see, for me, and this is again, having hindsight, I was like, oh yeah, that was super obvious. But you know, obviously, when you're watching the first time, you don't have that.
I figured out that people that were getting numbers up their heads were dying quickly after that.
Oh yeah, right.
But I didn't know why they were the ones being
or what the numbers on their heads meant.
Like what they actually numbers meant or what like. But it was clear that like you get a number on your head,
you're gonna die. Yeah,
like,
right.
And
right,
so I didn't know what was causing the numbers and why they were dying and stuff like that. So. Not until it was kind of revealed. I was like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. I was just kind of curious because, again, I'd seen this and I knew what they were getting at. I was like, oh, yeah, it was really obvious. But, again, I couldn't remember, honestly, what my first reaction was when I watched it on TV. I was like, I don't think I figured it out. But I thought it was kind of a cool little mystery. A couple little things I want to touch on theme-wise. Did you guys pick up on some of the spiritual themes in this movie?
There was a little bit, especially when... The first time I think that you really get to see it is when Ray dies. You see him running down the street, and I think Michael J. Fox's character, Frank, says something to him. He says, "Why didn't you take the court order?" or something like that. It was kind of a funny scene. Honestly, he's like, "Oh, I'm 29. I'm not ready to die." He's like, "Dude, you should have just gone. You should have just gone to the afterlife." He's like, "It's okay. In another year, you'll get another chance to go to the afterlife. Just take it then." That's the first time you can see it, like, you know, the idea of, like, okay, you get to choose in the afterlife whether you want to stay on the, you know, in the spiritual realm on Earth or if you want to go. And then the more you go on, the more you see, like, you see some spirits, like, go lifting up to what you perceive as heaven. Right. And then later on, you even get to see some spirits that like go to hell and things like
that. Which is really interesting. I thought it was really funny when he figured out the big reveal at the end. He's like, he thought, well, we'll get that in the spoiler section, actually. Right. But it was interesting how they dealt with what determines whether someone goes to heaven or hell. But I thought redemption was still a really key, huge key theme in the movie.
Especially at the end.
Especially at the end, too. But Frank Bannister was trying to redeem himself, and these ghosts that were left behind, again, they had unfinished business they were trying to redeem themselves for. Even though they already had the choice to get out, some of them, Ray for different reasons, but some of them actually were trying to kind of redeem themselves for their past sins and stuff like that. I thought that was particularly interesting. And obviously, we'll get into the ending there with Michael J. Fox's character, Frank. His whole character is kind of this redemption, like having... being able to move on and live and fess up to his mistakes. So, but I think we've about covered all we can without going into the spoiler section. So let's head there.
Spoiler.
So what I was getting at with the redemption thing, Frank Bannister in the movie, guys, basically you find out that the reason he's psychic is because he got in this wreck with his wife. They got in a fight. And she died, but not from the car wreck. It's because ghost of Johnny Barlett came and killed her. Now, Johnny Barlett, they set up early in the movie, was a serial killer who wanted to set a record for most killed by a serial killer. That was his whole ploy. He was a psychopath. He gets killed, electric chair style. And basically, you find out that there's this demon thing called death going around killing people, and they're writing numbers on it. Well, what ends up happening is the numbers are writing on. He killed 12 people when he was alive. And then Johnny Barlett, every person he was going to kill, he left a number on their head. Well, earlier in the past, after the first person he killed after coming back as a ghost was Frank Bannister's wife. So Frank felt very responsible for that, because if they hadn't gotten the argument, they wouldn't have gone off the cliff. And then she wouldn't have died, and the ghost would have taken her. So he feels responsible in this whole movie. He's kind of getting at that. And then it was interesting, he had that house. The whole thing is, he was an architect building this house, and he never finished the house after they died. They left it at was. And it was really funny, because the thing they got in a fight over was something really dumb.
She wanted a garden, and where the garden was supposed to be placed, he laid down 4 feet of concrete to make a basketball court.
But then you find out later, though, that after she died, he planted a garden there in her memory type of thing, and he kept it and everything. Yeah. So I thought there was definitely he had a lot of guilt he was carrying in the movie. So for him, the movie trying to take out this ghost and was kind of like his chance at a second chance, especially when he noticed the numbers on the head. And the numbers, Johnny Barlett, had killed 12 people, and then after that, all the people he was going to start killing after that, he would, right before they would die, they'd have numbers that would appear on their heads telling what victim they were, basically. So at the end of the movie, you find out that Johnny Barlett had this girlfriend who assisted him in the killing. They weren't sure if she had done it before, but anyway, she helps him assist him in the killing, and then she is still helping his ghost kill people. So that ends up being this big showdown in the hospital that he went on his killing spree in originally, between his ghost, the FBI agent, Frank Bannister, and Johnny Barlett's girlfriend.
Patricia.
Sorry. Thank you, Patricia. And they're all kind of having this... It was a very interesting... It was actually pretty cool. You were kind of...
It was very suspenseful.
Yeah, because you had... I mean, the FBI agent really was the wrench in the plan, because, it was like, he's got this. It's actually pretty straightforward, other than the fact that he shows up and kind of wrecks everything.
He was very third party.
Very much so.
To this whole thing.
Yeah, really. He really was the outside third party. He had no connection to the case, or other than the fact that he was convinced Frank Bannister was a psychopath.
Yeah.
So, I thought that was pretty cool. And in the end, basically, the scene we were kind of referring to with heaven and hell is Patricia and Johnny end up going to hell at the end, and a really interesting scene. This is one of the scenes for me, the poor CGI took out the most by far.
It did.
The portal turns from like this little like light thing that leads
nice
to heaven.
Nice little blue light.
Blue light takes you to heaven, to like this red thing with worms like come out of the sockets and like eat their faces and crap.
Yeah.
And it's actually a giant worm that goes back down to hell. And the whole thing looks like mega cartoon. Like literally, we have video games that look 10 times better than this these days. I mean, it's It looked bad.
96, man.
It was 96. But yeah, that kind of wraps up spoilers. Well, you guys have, what was your overall thoughts about the ending now?
Well, this isn't as much as the ending, but I didn't see Johnny Bartlett being the Reaper character. I really didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
That really kind of got sprung on to me. I enjoyed it. I mean, I thought that was a really good little twist because, I mean, since he had died, you know, all these other people had, you know, been getting higher kill counts than him, and he was, you know, trying to be the best.
Right.
Even though he was already dead, he was still getting trying to get still more and more.
Still notorious, right.
He wanted to be, it was a funny line, he said, this record should be held by an American. And I was like,
yeah.
I don't know if I want that to be an American record or not. But I thought that was a really neat twist because he was being hidden by the Reaper Death. He really resembled what I would think Death would look like. You know, a hooded, cloaked figure, even had the scythe and everything.
Ghost of Christmas Future.
Yeah, the Ghost of Christmas Future.
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really cool how they tied that in there.
Yeah, I'll say that. I agree with that. I didn't see it coming, and I, you know, it made sense. It logically made a lot of sense within the context of the movie, and so in that kind of regard, it was an all right ending. I thought I did feel like they kind of dragged it out a little bit at the end. I kind of felt like, man, like it's still ending. Like, you know, I felt like it was a little bit too long. They could have shortened it just a little bit.
That last scene, Tim back on his own property, was kind of pointless, honestly.
Well, that really.
I mean, it was okay, but again, it was just one of those things that the movie felt like it had already.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But then we wouldn't have known that she could see ghosts after her traumatization.
But really, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't hold
significance. They have something in common.
They
have a connection.
Fair enough.
They're going to get married.
For romance.
They're going to finish the house.
Whatever.
They're going to be happy.
Right. Well, okay.
And they're going to live and not focus on death.
But before that, even that last scene, I felt like it dragged it just a little bit. They tried to have, you know, couple extra ghost scenes in there. I felt like just a little bit. They could cut like 10 minutes out. That would have been a lot better. But in the end, I still liked the ending. I thought it was fitting. You know, it made sense.
Well, you had to find out what happened.
It was a safe movie, safe ending. I thought the twist was kind of cool. And again, I kind of wish I could have seen this for the first time again, because I didn't remember much about the movie, but I did remember kind of like once the pieces of the puzzle were kind of laid out there, I was like, oh yeah, I know exactly how this goes. But I was like, oh, I kind of wish I could be watching the first time again, because I don't want to see it on TV a few years ago. So it was, I mean, I thought it was enjoyable. I think it was very safe, not particularly creative, fun. I think it was fun and enjoyable.
Oh yeah.
Would be my last thoughts. And I thought it did kind of have a little wrap up, but ultimately, kind of forgettable almost. I guess we can go ahead and start wrapping up here. Two things. Did you guys catch the Peter Jackson cameo? It was, you had to really pay attention.
I didn't see it.
Was he a ghost?
No.
Oh, dang it.
Dude, he was a dude. It was so funny. And he was a dude. He was like Michael J. Fox right before he ran into Ray.
Did he run through him?
No, there was a guy who walks out of a tattoo parlor with a bunch of piercings.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't actually see his whole face, but you see like the beard, and you like, get a glimpse of his face, and then it has that shirt on. The death shirt.
I'll have to, that
was Peter Jackson. Just
I'll have
fun,
to go back.
Fun right. Tidbit there. Yeah, it's fun. People, Easter eggs. Check them out. Okay, now, let's go ahead and sound off our grades. Bama, what grade?
I'm going to give this a good, solid B. I honestly can't go much further than that. Like we said, very safe movie. Didn't really try to be one or the other, a comedy or horror. I mean, it did well, but it could have done more with that. Acting was great. Probably my favorite part about this was at the ending, they played the song Don't Fear the Reaper.
Yeah.
By Blue Oyster
By the way, no.
It wasn't a cover,
and I thought it was a terrible cover. I actually marked that down here. That was a terrible cover.
It was a terrible cover of Don't Fear the Reaper. But I thought it was very fitting for the movie.
Right. Yeah, it was a good pick. It was like we can't get the actual Blue Oyster Cult songs for too cheap, so let's get this really crappy cover. It was a fitting song.
I thought that was really cool. That definitely made me enjoy it a little bit more and that's a little bit more
like
comedy from it.
Yeah, and it's like when as soon as you start playing, you're like, oh, look at the song they picked there. It fits.
So, but yeah, a good solid B. Not great. Very enjoyable, though.
All right. Stall.
It was an enjoyable movie. It doesn't hold up in time that well, but it was enjoyable. I did have fun watching it. So I'm going to go with a B minus.
B minus. Wow. You guys are being a lot more generous on this movie than I'm going to be. I like this movie. Don't get me wrong. I don't think it holds up. I don't think it does anything very creative. I don't think it does anything great, even. I think it's got identity issues. I think there's a lot of problems with it. However, that doesn't mean I can't like it. I still enjoy it a lot. And I'd probably watch it again sometime, honestly. It's got some laughs and fun. But at the end of the day, nothing special about it. Nothing creative, particularly creative about it. Other than Michael J. Fox, the acting is nothing in particular. So you know what that means? He gets a C for average. And that's my grade. All right, now that we have reviewed The Frighteners, let's move into our buzz section, see what we're fired up about this week. What is happening? What is exciting? All right. Bama, Bama, what is up? Bama, Bama. Caffeine Man. Yes. He's a guy from, never mind.
Okay,
internet joke.
Whatever. Well, my buzz item actually doesn't happen until May 7th, but I just read about this probably sometime after we recorded the last podcast. Rick Riordan, one of my favorite writers, he's done some adult books. I wish I could remember what the names of them are. But most recently, he's been doing some not children's literature, more young adult literature with Percy Jackson series, Heroes of Olympus, The Kane Chronicles. Two of the series are based in Greek, Roman mythology. And the Kane Chronicles is more based with Egyptian mythology. He has a book coming out on May 7th that is called The Son of Sobek, which is a crossover between these two universes. And this is very interesting because with how he does each universe, I'm really interested to see how they're going to fit it, because with Greek and Roman, with the Greek and Roman books, all the children have powers because they have a godly parent, so they're all demigods. But with the Egyptian side, they are all descendants of the gods and pharaohs. So they have more magical based powers. They're not really as combat like as the Greek and Roman side is. So I'm really interested to see how these two worlds are going to interact with each other. And they actually mention each other in the books. I know, especially in the Egyptian book, they talk about, because both books take place in New York, and they talk about the other side of the river where the other gods are at. And they don't mess with them. They just stick on their side of the river. So I thought, interesting that they
stay on that side of the train tracks.
Yeah, stay on your side of the train tracks. So I think it'll be interesting to actually see these two worlds collide eventually.
Cool.
Very cool. Very interesting. If you're into mythology, we're checking out. Dull.
You know what? I'm pretty sure the last three times that I've talked in the bus section, I've talked about something. I'm going to continue.
You're going to keep talking about it? He's going to keep talking about something. Do we mention the something?
Today, I went to the library. I was like walking through the library. I was like, you know what? There are books in the library. Books that I want to read in the library.
There are books in a library.
So I hope there are books in the library.
So it's spoiler section. There are books in a library.
What's next? DVDs in a video rental store?
What?
So I went to the fiction section because the book that I wanted to read was in the fiction section.
Well, red alert. Fiction. There is a fiction section.
And I went to the Martin section.
Oh my gosh, Martin.
And I looked at all the different Martins. I picked up a book. I checked that book out, and I'm reading that book. And that book is called A Game of Thrones.
Not Game of Thrones, like a TV show. A Game of Thrones.
That's right. And it is the first book in the series of the series is called of Ice and Fire.
A Song of Ice and Fire
is what the series name is. This is obviously the first book in that series. And as we talked about before the show, well, I started reading the book, and I'm only like 40 pages in. That's about three chapters in. But I am very, very surprised at how well the TV show has done exactly what the book basically is. It's almost translated almost
it's
exactly.
It's really close.
It's very close, which It's kind of cool. Which, but reading it actually has helped me get a lot of like background that the show is unable to do. Helps you understand some things better.
Well, and there's a lot of things that the show does, like they explain, but like it doesn't have the same impact as if you see it or read it.
And it's also helped me get down the names better. There's a lot of characters in Game of Thrones, and so reading the book has actually helped me get down the names a lot better because I have to read them and see them spelled out and things like that. So it's been good to kind of read it. I'm going to try to finish that up, you know, this semester and see how that goes. So anyway, that's something I'm excited to finish the book, even though I already know what happens. Because
just, season just get one. To book three. Just get to book three.
So I don't know if I want to read the books before.
I thought the same thing when I finished the thing, and then I was like, nope, I can't wait.
I don't know if I want to read the third book. I don't think I'll get to the third book before season three comes out. But
before season four is done, though,
I don't know if I want to pursue the books before the show's out because I've been enjoying it so much watching the show brand new with some of my friends. So
it's true.
I don't know if I want to spoil myself and just look at them and be like, oh, I know stuff that you don't know. Ha, 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 ha. Like Caleb does to me all the time.
I don't like doing that, though, but it's like one of those things, like, you're like, you see the writing on the wall, and you're like, oh, my gosh, they're doing that. I don't like to rub it in your face.
Don't rub it in your face. You don't rub it in your face. You totally did during the trailer, though. You were like, oh, I know what that flaming sword means, man.
Oh, I know, and it's going to be so awesome. Okay.
Oh, shut up.
It's going to be awesome.
But Game of Thrones, excited about it.
So, Stoll, this is his fourth week in a row.
I think it's my third or fourth week in a row talking about Game of Thrones.
So all you need to know is Game of Thrones is awesome, which brings me to the point before we get to my buzz item. Hey, we're talking about doing a Game of Thrones fan cast and taking a break from the BCD. We need your opinion, though, because if you viewers speak up and you want more BCD, we'll give you more BCD. It'll come in the form of season two. So anyway, BCD or fan cast. Tell us what you think. Should we do a Game of Thrones specific podcast where we all sit around and talk about Game of Thrones, and we'll probably be us and at least two or three other gentlemen. So, maybe a lady every once in a while.
Guaranteed, I will talk about Daenerys a lot.
Guaranteed, I'll tell
That's
you.
Good.
That
That's good.
I don't like her.
That's good. That's good.
Discussion.
See, look, we're already getting into it, guys. We're getting into it right now.
So anyway, and like I said,
I'll talk about Arya.
We'll have
a
bunch of guys, and then maybe even a couple girls, because there's actually quite a small percentage of people on this campus who watch Game of Thrones.
All
I know.
It's a lie.
Mind blowing, right?
It's a lie. Just
all
like
I
the
gotta,
cake.
All
just
I gotta
like
say.
Cake. Oh my gosh.
Dragons.
You know what? All right. Hey. Anyway, my buzz item. StarCraft II, Heart of the Swarm.
Has it awakened the dragon within you?
Don't even make that joke.
Dragons.
Don't even make that joke. Okay. StarCraft II did awaken something to me, though. I'm playing through the first StarCraft II. Came out in summer 2010. The first expansion pack. That's right. Expansion pack. You know, things that you only come out later that year. Yeah. The second, the first one of the two is coming out next Tuesday. I will be getting it. I have already bought it and pre-downloaded it. And I will be playing that game tonight. I am playing through the first campaign game because it's been a couple of years since I played it. And I'm kind of fuzzy, a little sketchy on a lot of the details of the story. So, huge fan of that. I love my sci-fi epics, and honestly, probably one of the greatest real-time strategies ever made. It's a huge esport worldwide. Tons of things I love about it. But anyway, I'm personally more invested in the story and the campaign because I always have been. I always found the story to be very intriguing ever since the first one came out in 1998. And I really want to see where they're going to take things with Kerrigan, for you few StarCrafts out there. You're going to raise the question, is she going to go Zerg, or is she going to go human, or is she going to, like, do both? Anyway, no one understands what the crap I'm talking about. But you should all go play StarCraft 2 if you get a PC that can run it. It's a great game. Really good game. Best real-time strategy out there.
No, the Koreans know what you're talking about.
The Koreans do. Koreans out there, please chime in. I want to hear what you think. All right. So,
no offense against Koreans, but
we are buzzed. I can't wait to get my and it'll be nice to get into a game. I actually haven't sat down and gotten into a game that I could really just get into in a while. So, I'm hoping this will be it.
Any game that's not a Zelda game.
No, I used Metal Gear Solid 4, dude. Remember? 2 days.
Yeah, okay.
We also had 2.5 weeks off of school. So it's not.
No, it was that long. It was 5 days. But anyway.
No, it was like 2.5 weeks.
No. It was not that long. We had a total of 5 days.
We had at least
total,
2 weeks.
It was a total of 5 days.
At least 2 weeks.
Maybe like semester long, but it was a total of 5 days.
At least 2 weeks.
Anyway. And I really got into StarCraft, the last StarCraft game, and I really get into Skyrim. Got into Skyrim. Fallout. Oh my gosh, Fallout.
Yeah, you do like.
There are those games that come out every once. Fallout more than Skyrim, but there are those games that come out every once in a while that I love to play and get slightly consumed by. And I think it's okay every once in a while, as long as
moderation
and moderation, being consumed in moderation.
Exactly.
You know, when I say consume, I mean like just one Saturday, you just sit down, you wake up, not in that order, and actually Saturday morning, that is that order. And you start playing a game, and you just play all freaking day. And then you're like, you know what, that was a great day off. And then everyone looks at you like funny and calls you antisocial and makes nerd jokes about you. Okay. Anyway, we're going to go ahead and wrap up. We're going to wrap this puppy up. The only movie opening this weekend that I'm aware of is going to make a splash is Oz the Great and the Powerful. By the time this podcast is live, I will have seen it, so you'll be hearing about it next week.
Better not say a word to me about it.
I will spoil everything.
Oh, no. Punch you in the
spoiler!
Face.
Dorothy goes to Oz in a
what?
Movie.
What?
Oh, spoiler! There's an Emerald City. Bet you see that. And, flying monkeys.
Dude, those flying monkeys look ridiculous.
They look way cooler than the original flying monkeys.
Well, when was the original made?
1930.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway. Okay. Anyway, so I'm pretty pumped about that, and we'll talk about that some next week. And if you want to follow us, get on Facebook, like us. We feel unliked. Unless
I want to be liked.
Unless your name is Megan Jones and you liked us last week. Thank you, Megan.
Yay,
Jones.
Megan.
You're a good person.
Go, Megan Jones.
I hope you actually listen. So if you want us to get shout outs on our podcast, you should go like us too, because we will shout out your name from here on out.
Megan, force people to like us and listen to us.
Go get all the MacU people to listen. All right.
I hope she actually listens. Just doesn't like us.
Doesn't like just to like us? Yeah. Okay.
Just go on.
Anyway. So like us on the BCD Flixers. Get on Twitter. Follow us at BCD Flixers. My personal is at BigCalKenobi91. If you want to hear rantings and such. Or at Masters_Review for my blog post. And please, feedback. We like feedback. Okay. And our next movie is a little indie comedy called Sleepwalk With Me. Be here and check it out. What's it about? Sleepwalking With Me? Check it out. Until next time. Ghostbusters! Ghostbusters!